This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sandra Oh, stars in the new Netflix comedy series, The Chair. She plays Professor Ji-Yoon Kim, the first person of color and the first woman to chair the English department at a prestigious college called Pembroke. This is the kind of barrier Sandra Oh is used to breaking, having been the first actress of Asian descent to win 2 Golden Globes, be nominated for an Emmy as a lead actress, and to co-host the Golden Globes. One of those Globes, as well as a Screen Actors Guild Award, was for her starring role in the popular thriller series Killing Eve as British intelligence officer Eve Pilastri, who's pursuing an international female assassin who goes by the name Villanelle. They develop a mutual obsession which becomes increasingly erotically tinged over time. The fourth and final season of Killing Eve is now being shot. For 10 seasons, Oh starred in ABC's medical series Grey's Anatomy as Dr. Christina Yang. Before that, she co-starred in the HBO comedy series Arliss about a sports agent. Her films include Sideways. Sandra Oh is the daughter of South Korean immigrants who came to the U.S. in the 60s, then moved to Canada, where Sandra Oh was born. Let's start with a scene from The Chair, which was co-written by Amanda Peet. Now that Oh's character, Professor Kim, has become the chair of the English department and is in a position of authority, she finds herself in a conflict zone. The college is hemorrhaging enrollments, and the older, tenured professors are being challenged by students and young progressive professors calling out racism and sexism on campus. In this scene, she goes to speak to an older male professor in her department. He's the chair of the tenure committee for Dr. Yasmin McKay, a young black professor known as Yaz, who's become a star in the department and has a big following on social media. Her classes are packed. Few students sign up for his classes. Instead of just lecturing while teaching Moby Dick, Yaz has her students make presentations about the novel in which they can talk about or rap their take on the story. Professor Kim wants the older male professor to strongly support tenure for Yaz, but she senses his disapproval. He's played by Bob Balaban. Sandra Oh's character speaks first.
Your tenure letter for Yaz is going to include material on her teaching, right?
Why wouldn't it?
I think it's important that you highlight how innovative her pedagogy is. The flipped classroom.
Well, I believe a specimen of that will be on display in today's seminar.
Could you maybe include a mention of it? Look, she is hot right now. She has over 8,000 followers on Twitter. I mean, that's more than all of us put together.
You know who judged himself by the number of his followers? Jim Jones, David Koresh.
Yaz is not a cult leader, Elliot.
Jesus only had 12 followers. I suppose that makes him a loser.
Because of her, our students are excited about literature that was written 150 years ago. I know in your heyday, that's all you...
How do you know? Right now is not my heyday.
Look, I don't want to pull rank here, but as the chair of the department,
well,
I need
sure
to do this.
Well, you sure settled into that
I am
role.
Not saying this as your supervisor.
Supervisor?
I am saying it is the best thing for the department and the right thing to do for Yaz, so just do it.
Sandra Oh, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the series. It is a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's so good to speak to you again.
Are there themes in this series that resonate in your own life about race, ethnicity, generational conflict?
Oh, my God. I got to tell you, just that scene, You see how Professor Kim, moment after moment, you see how she's just shifting and folding herself, trying to get what she wants. Like trying to get what she wants out of Elliot, played by Bob Balaban. She first starts by cajoling, and then she starts by kind of like, oh, bringing him into the cool side, then to recognize him, and then she just gets angry. And so something like that, you know, like all the different ways you just need to learn to try and get people to do what you want them to do so you can like run your department. I mean, I feel all of us understand that. But going to your question about, like, you know, the greater themes of being a woman and a person of color, you know, in an institution, I really, really understand that profoundly.
There's a scene in which there's a Korean ceremony that's held for a one-year-old. I'll ask you to describe the ceremony and if you're familiar with it from traditions in your own family or not.
Oh, sure. It's a 100-day ceremony called Dojabi. And basically, on the 100th day of the baby's life, there's a big celebration, there's lots of food, But what happens is that you put all these objects in front of the baby, and all these objects mean something. Like a pencil is a writer, you know, a pot is a chef, you know, money is money, you know, and it's whatever whatever the baby crawls to first and tries to grab is supposedly their destiny, you know, tells their future. So it's a fun ceremony. Not that I had one.
Did your parents have one when they were growing up?
Well, you know what? Actually, I don't know whether my parents had one when they grew up. It was a tough time in Korea, you know, the occupation and all that stuff. So I don't know. I should ask them that. But it was only my brother who had one.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, my brother had one.
How come he had one and you didn't?
Oh, come on. I'm like the middle child. I'm the second girl. I didn't get one.
So in the past year or so, you became pretty outspoken about anti-Asian attacks and crimes. And, you know, this was during COVID, and it was during the period which, I don't know, are we still in this period when there's a lot of anti-Asian attacks? In part, I think, would you agree that this is in part because of Trump when he was president calling COVID the Chinese virus?
You know, I would like to put it all on one person, but it's not. You know, obviously, racism runs deep, and it's still going on in a way where people still feel frightened, and they're frightened for their elderly parents and grandparents, and they're frightened for themselves. It's a tough time. It's a tough time, and it's as it is a tough time for everyone. And it is, you know, again, what your point of view and what you make of it. I think what you might be referring to is after the shootings in Atlanta, we were shooting in the chair, and I was in Pittsburgh. And I for me, I don't consider myself, you know, a big activist. It's just about the need to connect. And it was that week and that weekend, I just knew there had to be a march or a rally somewhere in Pittsburgh. I mean, there's a lot of universities there. And so I found one, and then I invited the cast and the crew, and it was really tough because, again, it was during COVID, and it was to even, you know, invite the crew to a gathering where there are lots of people, and most everyone was masked. But it was an important thing for me to do because I just felt like I needed to connect with the Asian American community. And I didn't really have, I don't really know what I had to offer other than to say, like, let's work through this fear that we have, because that's what will destroy, you know, is if we bend to the fear.
Did you experience that fear directly?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. In the ways that of, you know, when you are a known person, wearing a mask is kind of great. Because people will give you a little bit more before they can figure out who you are. So I've relished kind of having pockets of my anonymity back behind a mask. But having said that, what has raised is that, oh, I'm clearly an Asian lady wearing a mask, and sometimes wearing a mask where other people are not wearing a mask. And you can just tell, as a woman, you know what I mean? It's as a woman, and you're walking somewhere, let's say it's dark, or you're walking through and there's groups of, you know, dudes, you know, everything just kind of goes up. You just get more aware, and you're ready for things. So I feel like absolutely, I know that. I know that I'm tremendously protected by my good fortune and privilege. But, you know, I'm also still an Asian woman.
Your parents immigrated from South Korea. Did they speak Korean in the house when you were growing up?
Oh, yes.
Are you fluent?
No, I'm not. I would say my sister's 5 years older than I am. And so when she first went to school, that's all she spoke was Korean. And then she didn't understand English well enough. And then my parents freaked out. And then they just started speaking English. You know, it has to do with what generation you are. Because I would say a lot of people, my generation, maybe the Korean-American community, the Korean-Canadian community, don't have the language. But the generation after us either are people's children, or I would say friends who are in their 30s, they have much more the language.
our generation, my generation, really, there is something that either it's the first one or the need to assimilate or whatever that was. Many of us do not have the language.
You were raised Christian. And what was your church like?
Oh my God, so much church, Terry, so much church. We would go to English-speaking church in the morning and then we would go to Korean church in the afternoon. Whew, I've spent a lot of time in church. And I'm so grateful for it now. I don't consider myself Christian now, but it has such a huge influence on me of just understanding, one, having a deep relationship with my parents who are very, very Christian, and two, just I think it helps you be an artist.
How so?
Because it helps you understand myth. It helps you understand symbol. It also helps you understand that there is spirituality in this life, and there's just different ways of getting to it.
How old were you when you stopped going to church?
Oh, when I left home, so 18.
Were your parents upset?
Yes, yes.
How'd you deal with that?
You know, I think that how I have grown in my my artistic life and in my life, I feel that they understand the spiritual purpose of how I am in my life. You know what I mean? Like my parents having a spiritual life and having a purpose as a person in society was a very important lesson. It was very important to them that you do something good for society and that you have a spiritual life, you have a relationship with God. And I did it my own way that they didn't want or they couldn't understand the choices that I made early on. But as time has gone on and they've seen the work that I've done, I feel like all those things that they taught me, I still try and do in my work.
You're speaking to us from London, where you're shooting the final season of Killing Eve. How did you get the part on Killing Eve?
Oh, they approached me in a very kind of classic way. They approached me with the pilot, and I said yes. But when I was first offered the project of Killing Eve, I remember I was standing on a street in Brooklyn, and I was flipping through the pilot on my phone while speaking to my agent on the phone, and I was asking her, I don't get it, like, who am I playing? And my agent was saying, Eve, you're playing Eve. And that was really like a significant moment for me for understanding where I was as a person and understanding, honestly, how profound my internalized racism was. You know, I've spent my entire career clearly and intentionally trying to make images that include myself and my community. And when I suddenly realized that I could not even see myself, I felt so ashamed and really sad.
So you couldn't imagine that they were asking you to do the title role?
Yeah, I guess so. I couldn't see it. I didn't know in that moment of like, oh, well, clearly there's a person named Carolyn and I think she's a senior member. Is it that part? I mean, I don't think it's the assassin villain part. I mean, it looks like she has to do all this, like, you know, fighting and stuff like that. I'm like, and is it this person? I didn't see it. It was something that was very, very offhand. You know what I mean? It wasn't only till later that I realized for me the significance of it. It was just in some ways an offhand comment, but it's just like, where did that come from? Where did that come from? Why couldn't I see? It's called Killing Eve. It's the title character. Why didn't I naturally think that's what someone would be offering?
Let's hear a scene from Killing Eve. And Eve is a British intelligence agent who's pursuing a young female assassin who goes by the name Villanelle. She's played by Jodie Comer. And in this scene, Villanelle has broken into Eve's apartment. And Eve she's terrified. But she's also really furious because she knows it was Villanelle who recently killed Eve's work partner. So this is their first face-to-face meeting, not under great circumstances. And so Eve finally regains her composure and tries to assert her power by telling Villanelle that she's investigated Villanelle and discovered her real identity and uncovered her past. So Sandra Oh is Eve speaks first.
I know you are Russian. I know you were in a prison in Moscow for 5 years until someone broke you out. I know you are exceptionally bright, determined, hardworking.
What else?
I know you are an extraordinary person.
What else?
I know something happened to you.
What else?
I know you're a psychopath.
You should never tell a psychopath they are a psychopath.
You should never tell a psychopath they're a psychopath. Might be very good advice. But after a pause, Villanelle casually eats some food that she insisted Eve give her, and then Eve asks her this question.
Are you here to kill me?
Or just watching you?
Who do you work for? Why are you killing these people? Do you not know?
Do you know who you work for?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Really? I think if you went high enough, you'd probably find we work for the same people.
As a scene from Killing Eve from early in the series. You know, the two characters, Villanelle and Eve, become obsessed with each other and even, like, work together at one point. And there's this, like, erotic charge between them that keeps getting more intense over time. Phoebe Waller-Bridge was the first showrunner of the series. Each season there's been a different woman who's been the showrunner. Did you talk to her about that erotic charge and how she saw it and how pronounced should it be? And I'm wondering, I have never read the novel, so I don't know if you read the novel that it's based on and how pronounced it is in that.
You know, so Killing Eve was loosely based on a book called Codename Villanelle by Luke Jennings. And Phoebe really took aspects of that book, likes the characters, and then really honestly put her own spin on things tremendously. And so one of those things that you're talking about, which is this kind of obsessive, erotic, ambiguous, but charged relationship between these two women. I tell you, in the first series, we never talked about it. Like, I swear, I can't remember we talked about it. And because she was writing it from a place, and I feel like Jodi and I were playing it from a place of there's these two women who want something from the other person. And that started creating a charge. And it wasn't, I think it really developed from how people kind of received it. And so for me, it's about a woman wanting and trying to be whole. I mean, I could say that hopefully for Jodi's character as well, but I don't know. But like for Eve, you know, for me in an overall kind of an overall arc, you have this every woman who's at a kind of plateaued place in her life, and she enters into this extraordinary world because of her relationship and a fraught relationship with Villanelle. And for me in a kind of psychological way, I just wanted to explore how this character of Eve becomes a whole woman and how she needs this other woman to become whole. And I think also within that is room for any interpretation.
There's a scene where you murder Villanelle's handler while he's strangling her. So you kill him to save her life. Because there's an axe lying on the floor. So you take the axe and you really don't want to use it. And he thinks she's never going to use it. And Villanelle keeps saying, like, do it, do it. And that we see you, like, take the axe and, like, you know, wield it. But and then we see blood splattering. But we never see the axe enter the body. We never see, you know, we never see he's not on screen as you're killing him. He's on screen later with the hatch, with the axe in his back, and with you trying to take it out. But you know what scene it reminded me of? In Sideways, there's a scene where Thomas Hayden Church, you find out he's like your boyfriend, and you find that he's actually getting married in a few days, and you're so angry, and you take your handbag and you wield it like a weapon, and you start like beating him with it. But he's off camera, so it looks like you're basically like hitting the sidewalk, you know what I mean? And that, because he's not really, he's like off camera. But so I was wondering if that's something that you wanted, or if that's the way that it was written, you know, that we wouldn't actually see the violence.
Sure. I think twofold. So in Sideways, it was actually a helmet that I'm hitting him with.
Oh, I thought it was your handbag.
Yeah, it was a helmet. Anyway, so...
No wonder you leave it there. I was thinking, like, who lifts her handbag? Okay.
Yeah, and so I was actually hitting... I was actually hitting Thomas.
You were?
I was actually hitting you. But what you might not remember is that basically he comes out with this big stuffed dog.
Right.
So I was actually beating the big stuffed dog just below camera. So he is falling on the ground and I'm actually hitting him, holding the dog. And then so for killing Eve, when Eve is killing Raymond with the axe, I think we had to do it for television purposes of not showing that much of a gruesome image. I mean, it's pretty gruesome, you know, but yeah, it's working out that desperation and rage. I never made that kind of connection, but it is kind of the same chopping motion.
How do you like working with fake blood? You know, because it's always disturbing to see blood on screen, but like you know that it's just like it's fake stuff. But is it disturbing anyways?
Oh no, not at all. I'm a pro at it. You know what I mean? So when I worked on that, when I worked on Grey's Anatomy, I mean, there's so much blood.
Oh God, of course.
All the different types of blood. No, I don't have a problem with that at all. No.
All right.
It's fun.
So you're shooting the final season of Killing Eve. You're in London shooting it right now. Are you filming tomorrow?
No, I have the day off tomorrow.
Wow.
It's great.
So what's the next crazy thing you have to do without giving away any plot?
Oh,
you know?
My gosh. Well, I'll just tell you this. Someone gets killed.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's intriguing.
Yeah, someone gets murdered in a gruesome way. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Fair enough. Sandra Oh, it's just been a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Sandra Oh stars in the new series, The Chair, which is streaming on Netflix. She's currently shooting the fourth and final season of Killing Eve. The new movie, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, is Marvel's first movie to feature an Asian superhero. The film stars the Chinese-Canadian actor Simu Liu as the young kung fu master Shang-Chi. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review.
The best moments in Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings are the ones where you almost forget you're watching a Marvel movie. Some of the hallmarks are still there. The deft comic banter, the high-flying action, the passing references to other characters and events in the Marvel universe. But the movie doesn't get bogged down in series minutiae. It takes place sometime after the last two Avengers movies, you know, when half the world was wiped out and then brought back, and several fan favorites said goodbye. But you don't need to know or care about any of that to enjoy this mostly standalone story, which brings us into new dramatic terrain. New cultural terrain, too. Nearly 50 years after the character of Shang-Chi made his comic book debut during the 70s martial arts craze, he's now the first Asian superhero to get the full Marvel movie treatment. When we first meet Shang-Chi, played by Simu Liu from TV's Kim's Convenience, he's a young man calling himself Sean and living a pretty ordinary life in San Francisco. But one day, he and his slackerish friend Katie, an amusing Awkwafina, are violently ambushed on a bus, and Sean fends off their attackers with a dazzling array of martial arts moves. Turns out there's a lot he hasn't told Katie, like the fact that he's a kung fu master who's been hiding for years from his father, a very evil, very powerful, centuries-old Chinese warlord named Wen Wu. Now his father has found him and sent his goons after him. Determined to figure out why, Sean flies to Macau, to meet up with his estranged sister, Jia Ling. Katie tags along, and on the way, he fills her in on some important details.
I should also probably mention that my name's not technically Sean.
What? What is it?
It's Shang-Chi.
Shang-Chi?
No, Shang-Chi.
Shang-Chi.
Shang.
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 S-H-A-N-G. Shang.
Shang?
Yeah.
You change your name from Shang to Sean?
Yeah, I don't...
I wonder how your father found
okay,
you.
I was 15 years old, all right?
What is your name change logic? You going into hiding, okay. And your name is Michael, you want to change it to Michael.
That's not what happened.
It's like, hi, my name's Gina, I'm going to go into hiding, my new name's Gina.
In Macau, the movie becomes a full-blown dysfunctional family drama with darkly funny overtones. At times, I felt like I was watching a comedy about the all-too-relatable tensions between a traditional Chinese parent and his wayward, westernized offspring, the one in which, of course, the fate of the world hangs in the balance. The siblings have to put their own issues aside and unite against their diabolical father, who derives his power from the 10 rings of the title, metal armbands that have made him immortal and almost invincible. Wenwu is the latest version of a notorious Marvel supervillain called the Mandarin, who was introduced in the 60s as a mustache-twirling Fu Manchu stereotype. But the filmmakers have smartly redefined the character, who's played, in an inspired piece of casting, by the Hong Kong screen legend Tony Leung. You might know Leung from his work in Wong Kar-wai's magnificent romantic dramas, like In the Mood for Love. Here, he gives us a more extreme vision of obsessive desire. Years ago, Wenwu tragically lost his wife, Shang-Chi and Jia Ling's mother. Now he's hell-bent on bringing her back, with a scheme that could have devastating consequences for all humanity. All this family angst gives Shang-Chi and the Legend of the 10 Rings unusual emotional intensity for a superhero movie. Jia Ling, nicely played by Meng-Er Zhang, resents her father for neglecting her as a child, which makes it all the more unfortunate that the movie somewhat sidelines her too. As for Shang-Chi, he has a complicated, vaguely Oedipal rivalry with his father, who turned him into the fighting machine he is, and subjected him to all manner of cruel manipulation and abuse. Simu Liu is an appealing lead, though he doesn't always fully convey the depths of his character's trauma. He's better in the lighter, funnier scenes with Awkwafina, and having worked as a stunt performer, he's terrific in the movie's extended fight sequences. They're a big improvement on the blandly staged, drably lit scenes that typically pass for action in Marvel movies. The director and co-writer, Destin Daniel Cretton, may not be the second coming of John Woo, but he's done a fine job of absorbing any number of Asian action influences, from the slapstick fisticuffs of Jackie Chan to the balletic grace of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Speaking of Crouching Tiger, it's delightful to see the great Michelle Yeoh turn up late in the show as a benevolent mentor to Shang-Chi. She prepares him for an epic showdown with his father that feels a bit like this series' past epic showdowns, full of apocalyptic stakes, bloodless casualties, and visual effects overkill. But the finale also has a depth of feeling that sets it apart and leaves you wanting to linger in this particular world a while longer, before the next Marvel movie comes along.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Shang-Chi and the Legend of the 10 Rings. It's now in theaters and will begin streaming on Disney Plus in October. Coming up, we listen back to my 1999 interview with Aretha Franklin. She's portrayed by Jennifer Hudson in the new biopic, Respect. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. The new biopic, Respect, stars Jennifer Hudson as Aretha Franklin. We're using this as an opportunity to go into our archive and feature an excerpt of my 1999 interview with Aretha, recorded after the publication of her autobiography. Baby, baby, sweet baby. Free. Queen of Seoul got her start in the Baptist Church. Her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, was a famous preacher. Aretha went on to receive many awards. She was the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She won 18 Grammys and was nominated 44 times. She received a National Medal of the Arts in 1999 and the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2005. She sang at President Obama's first inauguration. We spoke after the publication of her autobiography, Aretha From These Roots. She seldom gave interviews, so we were thrilled to have her on our show.
Before you sang soul music, you sang gospel in the church. I imagine gospel was more than just music to you. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, feeling the spirit when you sang?
Certainly gospel was my background, is my background. My upbringing was in the church. We had to attend regularly. And, of course, the church provided a training ground for me, so to speak, as a young vocalist, and certainly gave me all of the spiritual values that I needed as a young lady.
I'd like to play a recording that was made of you at the age of 14, singing in the church in which your father was pastor, the New Bethel Church in Detroit.
Yes, New Bethel Baptist Church.
And this is a recording of Precious Lord. The version we're going to hear was made in 1956. This is the young 14-year-old Aretha Franklin.
When my
That's the young Aretha Franklin. Let's talk a little bit about the influences on you during your formative years. First of all, let's talk a little bit about your father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin. He was one of the most popular preachers of his generation. He was nationally known through his tours and through, I think, radio broadcasts as well as recordings. You say in the book that church nurses carried smelling salts to revive worshipers who were overcome to the point of fainting by the Spirit or by your father's sermons. What was it like for you to watch your father speak and people fainting in church?
Well, it was tremendous. I love going to church. I enjoyed being a part of the choir and just doing things in and around the church. But as a young girl, I certainly enjoyed watching and listening to my dad.
You toured with your father through churches, through the Deep South, and I'm wondering what it was like for you during the days of segregation to tour through the Deep South, you know, how that compared to what you were used to in Detroit.
Well, it certainly was not what I was used to or accustomed to in Detroit, but on the other hand, it was not that bad. We didn't have extreme experiences of any kind, but there were times that we were asked to go to the back of the restaurant, say, or we couldn't use the bathrooms, and we got information that Gulf You could use the bathrooms there if you, and we didn't buy gas where we could not use the restrooms. So we went to golf a lot, I must tell you.
You say about your father, he was a minister, he was also a man, and that some women pursued him aggressively night and day.
They did.
So he wasn't uncomfortable with that.
I have no idea. I never discussed it with him, and he never discussed that sort of thing with his children. But as children, we could certainly see that women were kind of aggressively taking off behind him. He was single at the time, and sometimes you might see it with a lady sitting on the front row, a little high, skirts a little high, a little short, things like that, or in other ways that we're all familiar with. You know when women are interested.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you describe in your new autobiography, great performers like Nat Cole and Art Tatum knew your father and would sometimes be in your living room at the piano. That must have been
something. Yes, that's true. Art Tatum was often a visitor in our home. He was a very good friend of my dad's, Oscar Peterson, and Arthur Prysock, Mahalia Jackson, of course, James, and he loved Sam Cooke. And he just really very broadly appreciated one's artistry when they were truly gifted and really good.
Well, you were living in Detroit, so when you decided to make pop records, I mean, the obvious choice, I suppose, would have been Motown, especially since Berry Gordy was a friend of the family. I guess Motown was a very new label at the time. But did you consider Motown?
Actually, no, I really did not. My dad and I had talked about it, and we really kind of had our sights set on Columbia Records out of New York. We knew that Columbia was a worldwide label, and I think the feeling probably was that the promotion would be better than, say, a Motown, or the distribution and the promotion and so on. And so we just kind of maintained that feeling that Columbia were, and other major record labels were the people that we wanted to talk to.
Well, you were signed at Columbia by John Hammond, who had earlier signed Count Basie and later signed Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. Well, I want to play the first track that you recorded with John Hammond, and it's Today I Sing the Blues.
Okay.
Without a word of warning, the blues walked in this morning and circled around my lonely room. I didn't know why I had that sad and lonely feeling until my baby called and said, "We're through." Yesterday, this time I sang a love song, but today I'm singing the blues.
In 1966, after your contract with Columbia Records was up, you moved to Atlantic Records, which was the home of rhythm and blues greats like Ruth Brown and Ray Charles, Laverne Baker, The Drifters, The Clovers. How did you end up at Atlantic?
We got a call. My former husband, Ted White, got a call from Jerry Wexler that they were interested in talking to and signing me at Atlantic Records. And we went over, we sat, and we talked to Jerry. Jerry offered a delightful little bonus. And, of course, the rest is history.
Your sound really changed at Atlantic, and so did your material. Mm-hmm. Did he set you down before you started recording and say, this is what I see for you, this is what I hear?
Yes, he did. Actually, where I had been in the booth most of the time at Columbia, and not at the piano, Jerry asked me to sit down and accompany myself. And that is where my career really took a drastic 160-degree turnaround. I just accompany myself in a very different way than most other pianists do. And I think that that was the factor that made the difference.
Now, your second single was Respect, which is, I believe, your still most requested song. How did you end up singing this Otis Redding song?
Well, I heard Mr. Redding's version of it. I just loved it. I decided that I wanted to record it. And my sister Carolyn and I got together. I was living in a small apartment on the west side of Detroit, and piano by the window, watching the cars go by. And we came up with that infamous line, the sock it to me line. It was a cliche of the day. Actually, we didn't just come up with it. It really was cliche. Some of the girls were saying that to the fellas, like, sock it to me in this way or sock it to me in that way. Nothing sexual, and it's not sexual. It was non-sexual, just a cliche line. Laugh In picked it up, and it just kind of perpetuated itself and went on from there.
Let's hear Aretha Franklin singing Respect. This song mean to you when you sang it? I mean, really, part of the backdrop of this song, it was a hit during the civil rights movement, and I think you know, Respect had a lot of meanings in this song for your listeners. One was, you know, just the respect you wanted from a man in a relationship, but it also had, I think, a larger resonance with the civil rights movement. You know, a kind of larger social cultural sense of respect.
Yes, in later times, it was picked up as a battle cry by the civil rights movement. But when I recorded it, it was pretty much a male-female kind of thing, and more in a general sense from person to person. I'm going to give you respect, and I'd like to have that respect back, or I expect respect to be given back.
You know, as we mentioned, the song, I think, resonated with the civil rights movement. Your family was good friends with Martin Luther King. How well did you know Dr. King?
Dr. King was a family friend and a very good friend of my dad's. And occasionally he would come to Detroit and spend time in our home or at our church, at my dad's church. I went out in the early days of the civil rights movement and did some performances for him along with Esther Morrow and Harry Belafonte and different other vocalists, Bernard Lee, who was a foot soldier, Reverend Jackson, with Dr. King in those days.
Aretha Franklin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. And it's been my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
My interview with Aretha Franklin was recorded in 1999. She's portrayed by Jennifer Hudson in the new biopic, Respect. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nespa. I'm Terry Gross.